This edition of Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 27th of January 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 186, with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
On the show this week, we'll be meeting Tony Juniper, the environmentalist, writer and campaigner who's now showing how natural processes are vital to the world economy, not just the world itself.
We'll also be holding the door, minding our P's and Q's and generally being on best behaviour as we welcome writer and theatre critic Henry Hitchings later. He'll be discussing manners and when to use them in our book, That's Always, unless Monocle's Tom Edwards is here.
And we'll be taking a literary trip through London to learn how the Second World War affected some of our greatest novelists and writers with historian Lara Feagle.
That's all to come. Plus, Tom Edwards will be here with his weekly news look ahead, and we'll enjoy some great music right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. That's the starting klaxon for today. It's number 186. Doesn't feel like an auspicious number, Andrew, but we feel great in here, don't we? We're doing it in Studio 2 today.
It's cosier in here. Yeah. Cosier in here.
Yeah, it's all right.
We can just about fit Tom Edwards in. He's kind of been snuck in beside us.
Here he is. He's here already.
He's sitting quiet. We can come to him in a moment.
He's got that face that says, no one's switched my microphone on. Looks like a little. Looks like a cat being taken to the vet in a cage. That's a good analogy. But let's write that down.
Yeah, let's put a little kind of blanket over him and see if he goes quiet until we need him. That will work.
I'm not a parrot,
he says.
Get the T-shirts ordered now with that on the front. I've had a funny week. I haven't felt great this week.
No.
I slipped out, didn't I?
Yes. So, in fact, one of these interviews, we have to confess, was pre-recorded during the week. And
did it all on his own.
And I did it on my own, because we weren't here.
Oh, well, sorry about that.
It was all about manners as well, and I think it was very bad manners of you to be
ill.
Off and away and ill.
It would have been worse. I'll just say this for our listeners. It would be worse manners to have done what I was doing while I was ill.
Okay.
In the studio with our auspicious guest.
We might need a room spray afterwards.
It was a digestive, exactly.
Digestive, not the biscuit.
Not the biscuit. Reminds me of my favourite interview of all time.
Which was?
It was the show after I finished working for TFI Friday, unfortunately, many moons ago, like 14 years ago. And Chris Evans was interviewing David Bowie. And he walked on, and he was quite an unruly guest because he just basically didn't want to talk about his new album at all. He just walked on and said, "Shall I tell you what, Chris? I've had gastroenteritis." And it's pretty good. It turned out to be an amazing interview. So okay. Maybe we could do it like that. So we can always use our bodily problems as a great kicker.
But if anything goes wrong, we can blame it on your dicky whatever. Good.
That's not a bow tie.
Okay, maybe we should get started.
Let's get started. Let's introduce Tom Edwards to the fray.
Keeping you in the loop and on the ball, this is Tom Edwards with his weekly look ahead.
What do you think about that? We told you we were going to get you a theme tune.
I don't even know what to think about that.
You said last week that you'd like a theme tune.
Oh, my God.
You said you wanted a jingle.
I was thinking of, like, chamber music, maybe some soft, rousing orchestral melody.
No.
It was like something from no contrapunctus for you.
It's quite 1970s football,
wow.
Isn't it?
It was. It was kind of Tom Edwards, Sport Report. It's like Sport Report on Radio 5.
I'm thrilled by that.
All right, so you've had that was your cue.
You're the only person on Monocle 24 who has their own jingle. Well, I guess Santiago has it for his basket, but you're the only.
That's true.
You're the only professional.
That's pretty moving. I just wonder if I can measure up after that.
Okay.
Probably not.
We'll try, have a go.
All right.
Let's go with your first story then.
Okay. Well, we're going to start. Something's happened tomorrow. Very serious. But I brought you a visual cue to help.
Okay.
Loyalists in Northern Ireland are holding a unionist civil rights rally. Now, there's the Bloody Sunday commemorations. Obviously, there was the massacre in 1972. Civil rights protesters shot by the GB Army. The actual anniversary is on the 30th, but there's a big march on Sunday. And loyalists in Northern Ireland are holding their own version. This is all about the flying of the Union flag and Belfast City Council's decision to stop doing so. And there's been a lot of protests. We've seen rioting in the streets. And I brought you a moody picture to look at so you can sort of see the streets in question. Lots of these big murals, of course, that are painted by supporters of the UBF. And I think it'll be very interesting to see, A, whether people can maintain control over this, and B, how much of an effect it has on the sort of ongoing, you know, peace process, the efforts that are being made within Northern Ireland to keep, you know, political processes at the forefront instead of this kind of social instability. So it'll be, you know, very interesting to watch whether, you know, there are more problems later today.
I love that photograph, actually. I'm sure there are many photo essays done of the kind of propagandist. It's kind of propagandist art, isn't it? It's kind of amazing stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, some of these are incredibly, you know, effective tools. And they've actually endured. You know, people thought, like, at the end of the Troubles, they would lose their impact, people would paint over them. But that method of expression has continued, sadly, as have, you know, instances of dissent on the street. So it'll be interesting to see what happens later today, whether order is maintained or whether we see more of the grim scenes we've seen in the last couple of weeks.
And, of course, then painted up afterwards.
Well, indeed.
Live to tell the tale.
Will we see more legends?
Yeah,
exactly. In mural form.
All right, Tom. Thank you for number one. I think that was serious news, but that's okay.
Okay.
That lived up to the jingle. I think we're gonna have a second one.
It's Sunday, it's midday, live from London. This is the Monocle Weekly. And with his look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards.
We had another one made for you as well.
What do you think about that?
I'm rendered speechless.
I love that. That's literally like sort of like mid-80s Radio 2.
Yeah.
That was incredible.
You get a round of applause as well.
Round of applause at the end.
It's like the big show, Steve Wright.
Oh. Well, funny you should mention that.
Do you have a story that matches with that? Because I'm a bit worried that yours.
Your
story is
about,
a bit earnest.
I know. I hope this
isn't
about.
Well, shall I try and avoid, you know, heavy duty sectarianism with this next question?
Yes.
Okay.
If you would.
I've got kind of a business story. Is that okay?
Yes.
Maybe still a little heavy. I'll try and end on an upward climb. Research in Motion, RIM, this is the makers of BlackBerry 10. On Wednesday, the BlackBerry 10 is launched, and obviously, this is a story we've kind of been following quite closely on Monocle 24, the fortunes of BlackBerry and the parent company. President and CEO Thorsten Heinz says this is going to be unlike any smartphone on the market today. He's hoping it's going to kind of revolutionise and re-energise BlackBerry's engagement with their corporate clientele, especially because a number of them have abandoned them. They used to boast of having 90% of corporate business. The likes of Apple's iPhone and others have challenged them. And there's always this frenzy around smartphone launches. We've seen ridiculous queues, people buying iPhones, that kind of thing. And BlackBerry are basically putting... I would not do that.
No.
It's just...
I don't think the BlackBerry kind of people are queuers.
They're not queuers, are they?
They have a bike to them.
They don't have time. They don't have time for that. But it'd be really interesting to see, I think, how this is received and whether it can sort of re-energise their connection with, especially, as I said, the big corporate contracts, which
and
are there.
It was interesting to see at the end of the week the share price for RIM was becoming a little bit kind of more robust, just as the Apple one, kind of, which is still many multiples of the RIM one, was falling on the realisation that perhaps Apple was becoming a more regular company and it couldn't expect these kind of massive profit boosts every single year.
What to say as well on RIM is don't Google image search that. As a verb.
You have to be very cautious.
Okay, thanks for that. Well, I think you've got a third one for us, as ever.
Bringing you all the news you need, it's Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards.
Nice. What do you think about that?
Can I just say, I think that was my personal favourite.
You like that one?
That had the rousing orchestral tone that I was looking
for.
You
think that's good?
I think that's me.
It's a bit martial.
I think that one would work in a cinema as well.
Yeah.
We could film this and then you're in the Odeons around the world.
It was like a Pathé news broadcast, wasn't it? It was an old
school. Shall I strip off?
No, please don't.
What's to the waist and bang a gong?
You have to pretend this is happening now for those viewing in black and white. So I think that you have to do it in a sort of Mr. Chumley Warner voice.
I was going to say, shall I affect
and hello and welcome to the news? Yeah, exactly. That's what you need.
Heavens above. What a treat. What a treat for all the senses it's been. Kind of more of a cultural one to finish on.
Okay.
On Saturday, it's the Directors Guild of America Awards. Often, you know, they herald the winners of the Oscars. They have this proud boast that only four times has their best director failed to take that award at the Oscars. But I always think it's more interesting who they honour with their Lifetime Achievement Awards. And it's the Czech-born, I'd say a legend of cinema, Miloš Forman. He's the 34th recipient of the DGA Award, following the likes of, obviously, Spielberg, Francis Ford Coppola, Stanley Kubrick, many others. And he's a really interesting character, and I think it's, you know, an apposite reward for his many endeavours. Of course, some of his most celebrated works, the likes of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or Amadeus, which were his big Oscar winners. But he's done some quite, you know, more left-field movies, especially kind of more quirky comedies.
Well, they're quite more left-field movies that kind of got big, weren't they? Yeah. Like Amadeus is quite a strange, it's a strange, great movie, but it's quite, they're all quite uneven films. What are the DGA Awards like? Because I guess they're kind of quite small scale and quite kind of, it's kind of one of those things where you want to be in the room because you do meet all these people.
That's right. They're very much more for the sort of Hollywood connoisseur. Mm. You know, there's this feeling of, a bit more inclusivity. It's, you know, recognising their own. The Oscars do that to a certain extent, and Golden Globes likewise. But as you say, there's a bit more kind of theatre, and it's all a bit hyperbolic, the other ones. This is a bit more about recognising, you know, artists and technicians in their field. And I think that's why his recognition will be probably welcomed.
We had a director in this week on the culture show, for the culture show, that was up for DGA this year, Lauren Greenfield, who did The Queen of Versailles, which she was kind of stoked. That's kind of like, I think it's a director's director award. Do you know what I mean?
Well, and,
like,
you know, they'll be rubbing shoulders, you know, with the likes of Foreman and others. And I think it doesn't have the same kind of slightly self-congratulatory quality.
Well, it doesn't have the crazy showbiz thing of the things. Having said that, I bet you none of the people in that room, Tom, have got not just one, but three theme tunes devoted to them.
So which is the one you want to keep for life? I think it's
decision time. We're going to have to push you now.
For me, it has to be the round of applause.
Okay, nice.
Tom wants a clap. We'll take that one.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Tom, we should... we'll give you now the theme tune possibly that you deserve. Thank you very much indeed, as ever.
Oh, that is... That's unbelievable.
For coming in with the news. Look ahead. As ever, Tom Edwards, needless of a round of applause. Thanks for coming on the Monocle Weekly.
Our first guest today is the writer and campaigner Tony Juniper. As a leading advisor on sustainability to organisations ranging from charities to international companies, his commitment to environmental causes is well known, and he held the position of executive director for Friends of the Earth until 2008.
Tony's new book, What Has Nature Ever Done For Us? How Money Really Does Grow on Trees, looks at not only how to save the planet, but how the planet can save us all money too. For example, he says better managed fish stocks across the globe could save us a fairly trifling $50 billion. Tony, welcome to The Weekly.
Hello.
So this book is about learning the value of nature rather than the cost of nature.
Indeed, and one of the things I've tried to get across through the stories in the book is the extent to which we're deluded and prevailing under this massive misapprehension that nature is somehow a drag on the economy and that efforts to meet environmental goals are going to slow down economic growth and stop job creation. Nothing could be further from the truth, and the book demonstrates through example after example how, in fact, the economy is totally reliant upon natural systems ranging from pollinating insects, which sustain agriculture, to soil fertility and recycling of nutrients in the soil by microorganisms, which obviously sustains food production as well. The way in which the water cycle is endlessly replenishing itself so that we get water coming out of taps. The way in which pests and diseases are managed by natural systems. And, for example, the way in which forests and peat bogs in the oceans are soaking up most of the carbon dioxide we're releasing from fossil fuel in power stations and cars. And obviously we're spending a fortune on renewable energy, and that's good, and we've got to do that. But we're misunderstanding the value of nature in providing these parallel services. So the book is hopefully going to convince people that, you know, we need to get beyond this false choice, economy or environment, and understand that the economy actually is the environment and start behaving in that new reality.
And presumably also acknowledging ourselves as part of nature rather than always using it as a noun to describe something else.
So. Exactly. And so everything we use, touch, and our entire economy is based upon nature. The only difference now is that we tend to be less able to see that because we're living in a world of concrete, glass, and steel. But all of the services which keep that going, basically you can trace back to natural systems, from the plankton replenishing the oxygen we're breathing right now, through to the tea and coffee we're drinking, through to the paper, wood and everything else. It's all coming out of natural systems ultimately.
The book has to do a tricky thing, because in a way you're trying to get over lots of kind of warning signals about what could happen and some very terrible things are happening in the world. But as a positive read as well, you bring in lots of very good examples of, you know, even big organisations like Unilever, or whether it's state or city governments, for example, New York City, how they're doing things to really kind of change the way that they do business. Are you quite hopeful that, certainly in the developed world, that some of these lessons are being adopted quite easily?
I'm optimistic across the piece, and including what's going on in some of the developing countries too. And really, the point, you're right, the point of the book is to be optimistic. It's about a warning in terms of what happens if we start to disregard nature's services and we degrade them to the point where they stop working. But I hope to convey in the book a sense of possibility by describing all the many examples of where people are taking steps to keep nature doing what it does, and in fact to enhance what it does, to add even more economic value. And you mentioned New York, a great example there, where in the 1990s the public water supply needed upgrading. There was a proposal to spend $6 billion on new filtration plants, reservoirs and water storage facilities. Some bright spark came up with the idea of being able to do all of that much more cheaply by conserving forests and wetlands and pastures, by paying small amounts of money to landowners to keep those things intact. And they did it for a fraction of the cost. And so instead of doubling New Yorkers' water bills by upgrading the infrastructure, they did the same job for about a fifth of the price. And example after example in the book, which I hope is going to bust this myth that somehow working with nature is more expensive than not. And the various bits of campaigning I do, I'm still surprised by how that mythology prevails everywhere. It's in the popular consciousness, it's in finance ministries, it's in boardrooms. And of course, the more we look, the more we realise that's a completely false way of looking at the world. Our best economic prospects are through working with nature, not simply because it sustains the economy, but even in our own narrow economic terms, it's often the cheapest thing to do.
I wonder that in the context of where many countries' economies are at the moment, whether this is a good time to be adopting these things, or whether you feel that it's slightly escaping from people, that they're people every day are kind of convinced that to look after ecology costs the economy, sort of thing.
Exactly, and that's why the book is written now, actually. I've been campaigning on environmental issues for a very long time, and I thought probably as we got deeper into this recession, this kind of argument would break out. And it's very obvious here from our Chancellor of the Exchequer in the UK, for example, who often paints this picture whereby we can't afford to meet environmental goals because of the economy needing to recover. And I think probably the timing of this is right, actually, because if nothing else, in a period of economic difficulty, some of the fundamentals about economics probably are more up for debate by people. And so hopefully some of the ideas in here will gain more traction than they might do during the good times and everything looks like it's fine and dandy. And as I say, you know, the picture I'm trying to paint here is one of economic opportunity as well as threat. And so even in these difficult times, we might find inspiration in here for how we can do what we need to do, but do it more cheaply.
You say you're reasonably confident about the developing world as well. But I think there's a quote in there from a Vietnamese gentleman who owns a billion-dollar company. And he says, nature is of kind of a finite resource. It's disappearing. I need to use it up as quickly as I can.
Yes. So he's the old mindset, if you like. And in that same chapter, I talk about the example of Costa Rica, where the country in the 1980s took a completely different view of the world in seeing the nature as limited, but not as something that needed to be liquidated before somebody else got it, but as the basis for future economic development. And so the president in that country during that period adopted a whole new way of accounting national income. And so moving beyond GDP to also include the state of the natural systems in the country, the forests, the wetlands, the rivers. And for good reason, not only was this sustaining tourism and sustaining agriculture, but those natural systems were also sustaining the national power supply. There's a clue in the word rainforest. It rains, it fills up the rivers. The rivers were powering the hydroelectric dams. They put two and two together. They reached four. They decided to change their national development strategy. And the key thing about Costa Rica, which I think is very inspiring, is how not only have they doubled their forest cover since the mid-1980s, they've actually doubled the GDP per capita income, thereby demonstrating through a whole country how it is truly mythology to see the need to liquidate nature in order to achieve sustainable development goals. So their people are richer, they're more comfortable, and they've got more forests than they started with. And I think that speaks volumes and actually shows how the Vietnamese gentleman has got it completely wrong.
And do you see, we talked about Unilever and certain companies taking this on and adopting this way of thinking as a way of saving money and putting something back and stuff. Are there kind of goodies and baddies in terms of the rest of the world, in terms of countries? Is it easier maybe to convince a developing economy that they can adopt this and take it on? Is it tougher to change the mindset of the developed world?
I don't know, actually. I look around and I see inspired people and organisations doing good things in different parts of the world, and I see people who really don't get it and doing bad things in different parts of the world. So I'm not so sure any longer it's so simple to say that it's a developing country, developed country kind of a split in terms of how we're going to make progress on this. And actually, if you think about it, you know, we're going to have to make progress everywhere in every context that countries are in. We're going to have to start from where we're at in solving these problems. And you know, I don't think there is any way, you just do the simple arithmetic, that we're going to get 9 billion people up to Western living standards through the same pattern of development that we've had to get 1 billion up to living standards like we enjoy now in the West. We're already over the edge in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, water withdrawals, soil erosion, damage to natural systems, resource depletion, with just a few of us in a global sense living the good life like Americans and Europeans. To get the entire Chinese, Indian, Brazilian, Indonesian, Mexican, and all those other populations up to a living standard like ours, there simply is not enough earth to go around. And so we're going to have to adopt different strategies everywhere. We're going to have to reduce our consumption here at the same time as lifting up living standards in the developing world. It's not a simple picture, but as the book hopefully shows, you know, there is inspiration from all different parts of the world. And I think it's a question of the mindset that we said a second ago, switching the way in which we're looking at our future prospects and seeing nature as a partner rather than simply as a series of resources to be plundered.
Use the phrase the good life as well. Presumably, maybe we need to change our definition of what the good life is.
Well, absolutely. And there's a whole great economic literature out there about how we measure things. And at the moment, we measure GDP, which is basically a proxy for how much resources and energy is being used up, whereas there's a whole academic literature showing us that we could be measuring something completely different about the length and happiness of people's lives and how fulfilled they are. If we started measuring that, we might get some very different outcomes for the environment as well.
When you write a book like this, it's always you wonder, as it goes into market, you think, I wonder who I can get to write a foreword. You've got a rather a good gentleman who's kind of agreed to write a few words to set your book up, Prince Charles.
Yes, he has.
How important do you feel that somebody like him, the heart of the establishment, is to the cause? And the other interesting thing, as I read his words, you know, if you hadn't seen his name on there, he's suggesting some quite radical things about how you rethink how an economy is run.
Exactly. Now, Prince Charles is one of those very rare figures who is at the heart of the establishment and who speaks about these things with passion and knowledge, and also now with a 40-year-long track record. He's been at this as long as people have really been talking about this in the modern context. And he is an enormously important leader, not only in what he's able to get across through the speeches and the articles that he does, but also crucially through the convening of different groups that he does through some of his charities and other activities, bringing people together to look for solutions, not in a way where he's telling people what to do, but by offering people a neutral space to bring different interests together to be able to compare notes on what solutions could look like. So he's a hugely important figure on this and someone for whom I have enormous respect, and I couldn't think of anybody better to introduce this book.
Tony Juniper, thank you very much. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
It's time now for a song. I think I've been playing this, I've been testing this out during the Atlantic shift this week. It's from a new record by Bombo Estéreo, a Colombian band. It's from an album called Elegancia Tropical, and this is El Alma y el Cuerpo. and that was El Alma y el Cuerpo New from Bomba Estéreo from Bogotá. And you're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. We'll be brushing up our manners in a sec.
Stephen Newland is a seaplane pilot on Queensland's magnificent coastline and is in no doubt that the colourful, dazzling, awe-inspiring Great Barrier Reef is the finest natural wonder in the world.
I'd have to say, especially around this area here, the water and the scenery is just incredible. The Great Barrier Reef just changes every day. It's never the same.
There's nothing like Australia.
Here at Monocle, we like to do things properly. But when we touch down in Tokyo or we jet off to Jaipur, it's always in the knowledge that observing the local custom and brushing up on some manners can go a very long way.
And this hasn't been lost on our next guest, the theatre critic and writer Henry Hitchings. He's written a book on how manners are the measure of not just your immediate surroundings, but also the history of a place too. Earlier in the week, he sat down with Andrew, who began by asking why British manners are some of the trickiest in the book.
Henry, thank you for coming in. First question... You talk very specifically in the front of the book about the difference between English manners and other types of manners. Why have you focused in on the Englishness of manners?
Well, I suppose there are a few reasons for doing that. I mean, first of all, I think in the sort of global pantheon of national traits, people put manners and English together rather the way they put efficiency with Germans. And you can say that that's ugly stereotyping, but it happens all the same. And I think it's worth exploring why that's the case. I suppose the story of this book is really about English people's obsession with manners, more than actually what English manners are. It's who have been the people who've propelled this obsession and how has that manifested itself.
Now, the stance you take or the route you take through the book is a linear one. It's kind of historical. You have you take a few detours to speak to real people about, you know, manners, and you look at the likes of table manners along the way. So this isn't a kind of an etiquette book. This isn't telling you how to behave at all, is it? This is really an exploration of the colourful world of manners.
Absolutely that. It's an exploration. I there are plenty of books you can read which tell you what to do with place settings and how to address a marquis or whatever it might be. I mean, actually, in the 19th century, etiquette becomes what people think of when they think of manners, and manners is increasingly divorced from morality, and it's a sort of cosmetic code, like a veneer, a gloss of details, of superficialities. And I think manners have an image problem. When you say, you know, I'm writing a book about manners, people think you're writing an etiquette book. And actually, one of the reasons maybe why we don't talk about manners and think about manners more is because immediately we think it's going to be a conversation about napkins and fish knives.
And the other, I think the important thing to point out is that, you know, you're not saying that manners are kind of fading away. You're saying that they're kind of fit for the time, really.
Yes, I mean, I think there's a tendency to say we're all going to hell in a handcart. It seems to me that if you look back historically, people have been saying that. Really, at any moment that you can isolate, it's not a new phenomenon to think that way. But I think it's very dangerous to talk in those terms. It becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. The issue now is that we have new things to have manners about. If you think about things like social networking, they didn't even exist 10 years ago. It's certainly the media through which we network now are new. And the protocols for dealing with those things have to sort of grow organically and by a process of accumulation. We don't like top-down legislation in Britain, and consequently these things have to sort of accumulate like a kind of coastal shelf, and that takes time.
And the manners, when you read your book, seem to reflect also social change. So at a time when perhaps a house had a huge amount of staff, you could be a little bit more fussy about your manners and make them more layered and complicated for other people to copy. But when you're kind of stripped of your servants and you're doing things yourself, then manners also need to reflect the kind of a simpler lifestyle that some people are forced to live as kind of the economy or society changes.
That's absolutely right. And you know, we're tremendously responsive to place. I talk about what I call the rules of place in the book, and how the place that we're in affects how we behave. And that may seem a rather banal point, but actually most forms of manners, most forms of behaviour are associated with particular places, and home is for many of us a place that we sort of suspend certain details of that.
Now there's
I must say, for anybody who's listening, the book is incredibly rich in anecdote and in research, and is also very, very funny. But I'd like to just pick out a few things and just get your comments on them. I thought very early on you talk about the fact that the English are kind of prone to apologise for something that they haven't done. And this is a remarkable nature. We say sorry a lot as English people. Do you think that that is a hint at manners, or is that just a kind of a linguistic thing that we've become straddled with in a way?
It's a linguistic quirk. I mean, it seems to me that a lot of the time when people use the word sorry, it's more like a piece of punctuation than actually an expression of sorrow. It's interesting, actually, in the 19th century is when people start to say sorry rather than I am sorry. So the sorrow gets detached from the person who's feeling it. And I think it's a sort of reflexive thing. I'm struck by just the sheer number of times people use this word every day. I actually went round for a while sort of totting it up because I'd read a piece in a newspaper which said that the average Brit said sorry 8 times a day. And in my experience, it was more like 10 times a day. And that didn't include my own saying sorry.
The other funny one, I don't know if it's in your book, that I notice more and more is people saying sir a lot. You know, when they get out of a taxi or something, thank you, sir. It seems to have come back with a kind of a younger generation using that as a kind of a polite form of addressing people. Even what's funny is it's often older people even addressing younger people. They're in a shop or something, that use of sir seems to have reappeared.
You're absolutely right. And I think that one of the issues that always comes up in manners is what do we call people? There's been a bit of a retreat from certain forms of intimacy. I mean, certainly some of the things which shopkeepers used to call women, like dear and love, would be considered unacceptable now. So madam has had a kind of resurgence as a result. The sir thing I've come across a lot, I get it a lot in restaurants, and I always wonder if it's a bit tongue-in-cheek, and I think wondering about that is sort of symptomatically English rather than taking it at face value.
Because interesting, in the book you do kind of mark in the 1930s when there was a falling away of the, even, and I didn't realise it happened so early, the use of Mr. and Mrs. And there was some harumphing that in fact people were being addressed by their Christian names too commonly. Is that the period that it really does begin, that people start feeling comfortable? Because even at work, I guess, people always call, you know, Mr. Clark, Mr. Smith, you know, that they didn't want to call each other, even who they worked with, by their first names.
It's something that springs up between the wars, but it's really more in the sort of 50s and 60s when you get into things like open plan offices and the whole kind of cult of informality in the workplace in particular, that this really sort of develops. I think one point to make is that because Britain is now a lot more multicultural, there are people coming from different traditions where honorific names, you know, monsieur and herr this, and, you know, cultures where I don't even know what the relevant words are, they're coming here. And sir and madam feel like quite good things to default to, because certainly if you come here from elsewhere, you're aware that there are all these names and titles and honorifics, and you don't want to get it wrong, but with sir and madam, you're quite safe. And I think maybe also that the issue about when you use someone's given name is a little bit of a blurry issue. But nobody ever minds the Mr. Tuck approach.
And tell me, one of the stories I really love is the kind of the arrival of the fork and kind of what this meant for kind of table manners. And there's a very nice description of being somebody being in Italy, I think in the 1600s, and they see somebody using a fork as rather than a kind of jabbing instrument, you know, as a personal fork for the first time. And it was this idea that actually you needed to have, people didn't want their dirty hands all over their food.
Yes, it was a traveller called Thomas Coriot, and he was in Italy in 1608, and he saw people using forks individually, discreetly, rather than having a single fork on the table for hoiking things from a communal dish. And he brought a fork back to England and was ridiculed for using it. What he identified as a particular advantage of the fork was you could eat berries without staining your fingers. So that's maybe not something we think of now, but the process of sort of evolution of table manners has been about making the sort of touching of food more remote from us, and it becomes a more specialised thing. So, for example, at a medieval feast, a lot of the cooking of the food and the preparation of the food would have happened in your presence. But there's a move then in the sort of Renaissance towards the preparation happening elsewhere. It becomes more of a sort of specialised activity, and you also get specialisation in domestic architecture, so that the hall and the place that you dine and the place that the cooking gets done are separated. And that's a sort of move that continues. In the history of domestic architecture is quite interesting, the specialisation of spaces and houses. But of course now the average person in Britain lives in a tiddly little place and doesn't have that specialisation, so things evolve.
And do you think in a city like London, where we have people drawn from all over the world, where we're likely to be offended more often, not because people from around the world have worse table manners than us, but I think you point out in the book, you know, that there are certain things, you know, for example, Japanese people, they like to slurp, and that the slurping is an indication that the food is good, and that actually for a Western ear, that's a little bit intolerable.
I think the thing is that to live in a city like London, you need to sort of develop almost a shield of cold indifference that you carry through life. And it's not rudeness. It's actually just a way of making life manageable, because you're being assaulted by stimuli the whole time in a big city. And, you know, there would be a kind of psychological and emotional overload if you actually responded to all those things. So you instead have this sort of veneer of froideur. And you carry that through life. And that means, I think, that we do tolerate people who do things a bit strangely. It was just this understanding that London benefits from being a melting pot, and sometimes unsightly things are the kind of, you know, the flip side of that.
And you talk about this idea, as we mentioned at the start of this conversation, about England being associated with manners. Do you think that the other countries around the world look at the English and think we are quite mannered?
I think they do. I think they also think it's this point that I was making. They think that we're obsessed with manners. They don't necessarily think we're terribly polite, but they think that we agitate about manners. I mean, it's very noticeable, some of the sort of guides that we have. You know, you still have things like Debrett's Guide to Correct Form. And actually, when I travel abroad, manuals like that tend to be less widely available, and certainly less respected.
And how much do you think these days manners is also about class? Because certainly reading back through your book, many of the instances where you see, you know, very sharply defined manners, they're connected to kind of wealth or prosperity, but they seem to be as much about kind of behaving well as about keeping other people out, in a way, the people with manners and the people without manners.
That's very true. We use manners as a kind of social filter. And again, one of the sort of great periods of flux in this is the Victorian period, because it was a period of much greater social mobility, and it became rather harder to work people's class out from other distinguishing features. So manners were used almost as a sort of mechanism for discriminating between people. And if you were a socially aspirational person, you then cultivated manners and indeed etiquette, which seemed like a kind of symptom of something underlying, in order to project a positive image of yourself.
Henry Hitchings, thank you very much for coming in. You've been one of the politest guests, and one of the best-mannered guests, rather, that we've ever had.
Thank you very much.
And that was Andrew talking to Henry Hitchings earlier this week.
We'll be looking at writers in wartime next, and asking why, for some, the Blitz held not only a sense of danger, but also a sense of allure. We'll be back after this.
Tully Kadar, a barista at Mecca Espresso in stunning Sydney, can't decide between the incredible warmth of the people and the outstanding beauty of the scenery when it comes to what makes life in Australia such a daily delight.
We have beautiful weather, a lovely culture, a unique sense of humour. Quality of life is just very high, and I'm very proud of the Aussie culture. I like our matter-of-factness. I feel like we have sort of a good balance between the outgoing, almost ostentatious American style and the very reserved British sensibility. I feel like we kind of land a healthy balance, and the culture's pretty cool.
There's nothing like Australia.
You're tuned in to The Weekly. Most of us, God willing, will never have to experience war firsthand. In some of the wars we see currently across the globe, it's difficult to imagine what moments of respite, if any, can be found while caught in a conflict. But our final guest, the historian and academic Dr. Lara Feigl, has been looking at the work of some of the 20th century's most celebrated novelists and writers during the Second World War to find out why those such as Graham Greene, Rose Macaulay and Henry Greene might have felt a twinge of excitement along with the uncertainty. Her new book, The Love Charm of Bombs, weaves those writers' work into a historical narrative. And Andrew met her earlier to learn how she did it.
Lara, thank you so much for coming to see us. The book is amazing, but it's quite a feat. So tell us a little bit how it came together, because it's the stories of a group of writers who all became well-known living in London. It's a snapshot of their lives during the war and kind of what happened to them emotionally. And it's a narrative about the Second World War that I don't think I've ever seen before. Just tell me, where did the idea come from, and how did you choose this group of writers, most of whom seem to have crossed paths at some point in their lives?
Yes, the idea came about when I was researching the literature of the Second World War in Britain and Germany. And I was going to write, I'm an academic, and I was going to write a literary study about the period. But I kept finding that I was drawn to the lives of the writers in this period, partly because they all had such intense love affairs. And I was sort of surreptitiously reading the more fun chapters in the biographies, and then thought, actually, these lives are so related to the books that they wrote about the war that perhaps I could investigate both at once. And once I got into it, I found that they all had this amazing time sort of involved in the defence of the city and right on the ground in the Blitz, doing very dangerous and brave things, and found that it was possible to reconstruct through using bombing records to reconstruct their day-to-day life as ARP wardens or ambulance drivers, and that they crossed paths not only at cocktail parties but sort of on the road whilst on duty.
I think that there are a few kind of myths punctured by this book along the way. I guess one of them was that there was all this, everyone had the same spirit in London. Everyone was, you know, gung-ho, they weren't scared of the Germans. But it was clear that many people were scared of the bombing raids, and many people changed their lives because of that, whether they thought they were going to die, I believe, in the sense of Graham Greene, who thought, you know, I'll never get through this, or other people who were living actually on the periphery of London. I hadn't realised that Wimbledon was such a dangerous place to live.
Yes, I mean, really, the whole of London was dangerous. So Hilda Spiel in Wimbledon, who's the least well-known of my writers, was also the most fearful. She was an Austrian exile in London during the war and didn't have the same sort of social networks and confidence, I suppose, that the others had in the centre of London. And so was really, and also because she had a daughter in her house, a small baby in Wimbledon, she was very scared. Graham Greene wasn't so much scared he was going to die as excited that he might die. He'd been a manic depressive all his life, apparently played roulette with a loaded gun as a teenager, although he later sort of half denied it, and went out each night excited by the sense that a bomb might fall on him, pleased that it gave him a sense each morning of waking up surprised to be alive and therefore enjoying life more than he had before. I think if I'm puncturing myths, it's not so much that people were courageous, because I think my writers were unusually courageous. It's more that it was only a sort of depressing and grueling time, because I'm showing that certainly for three of them, it was an oddly exhilarating time. And also, I think I'm showing that the kind of the London can take it spirit could be a bit more decadent and odd, perhaps, than it sometimes seems. And that they sort of weren't drinking tea and cheering. They were more likely to be getting very drunk and
having sex,
yeah.
which I understand. Now, we should just quickly introduce the cast of characters then. So who are your team of writers that you've kind of dragooned into the book?
My team of writers. So I've mentioned Hilda Spiel in Wimbledon. There's Graham Greene in Bloomsbury in a passionate love affair with Dorothy Glover, a fellow, she's a shelter warden. There's Elizabeth Bowen, the Anglo-Irish writer, who would go on to write The Heat of the Day about the Second World War. Beautiful, feisty, sort of feeling grown up for the first time in her life, falls in love at the end of the Blitz with the love of her life, Charles Ritchie. It's sort of one of the most passionate wartime affairs that I write about. Henry Green, actually called Henry York, who's an aristocratic sort of factory owner's son who writes secretly under the name of Henry Green and is enjoying being a fireman and finding that with his wife and child in the country he can seduce women in nightclubs and sort of enjoy the fact that the firemen are heroes. And then Rose Macaulay, who's really the saddest figure in the book, who is 59. She's an English eccentric. She's sort of always to be found at cocktail parties and feistily sort of swimming whenever she goes to friends' houses. She jumps in the nearest pond and sort of has all these English eccentric habits. But this hides a very passionate and sensual exterior. And she's had a 20-year love affair, which is really almost a marriage. I mean, for her, it really is a marriage with a man called Gerald O'Donovan, who's a married former priest and now novelist. And he is dying in the war. And at the end of the Blitz in May 1941, her flat is bombed and she loses all her possessions, including all the letters he'd written her, and is terribly sad. So her sadness is a sort of the offside of the intensity, I suppose, that if everyone is feeling more extremely, then it makes loss as well as...
Well, and the amazing thing about her, if I've because you do give everyone's, it's quite mapped out, this book, in many senses. You get the geography of the city clearly in your mind. I hope I remember this correctly. She lived but a few hundred metres from our front door.
She did,
She lived just on the other side of the park that Midori House looks out on.
Yes, yes, on Loughborough Street.
And that, and you see now a contemporary block of flats there.
Yes, which has replaced hers. Yes,
replaced her home. That's,
I spend a lot of time wandering up and down that road. Thinking,
so I can
really
look out the window from my desk and I can see where that bomb fell and where her life was extraordinarily torn apart. There are so many wonderful sentences in this book that kind of bring to life a period which terribly, I think, we kind of forget when we move through a city. And I just wanted to read, listeners, one line from the book very early on. It says, it's just summing up what we think about that period. It says, you know, books were written, parties hosted, love affairs initiated and broken off. But the books, parties and love affairs were infused with the danger of death. Every aspect of life was refracted through the lens of war. And I think you have this real sense of people, they get out, they know this could be their last day every single time they get out of bed. And even though we know through history that these extraordinary characters are going to write books and they're going to be, you know, important now, they don't know it as we read their diaries and we meet them on the page.
Yes, which is at once terrifying and exhilarating, because if each day might be your last, then you have to make the most of it. And every moment is an extraordinary gift, I suppose, which you have to live as intensely as possible.
So tell us about sex. Is it because there's hinted at in this book, you know, that there's, well, hinted, you describe how there's a democratisation of London as perhaps has never seen before. You know, you talk about Henry Green, his volunteering. He loves the fact that he's with all these people that are not from his class background, that there is a kind of in it together. And did that make the possibility of sex between the classes and being different people to seem much more accessible for the first time ever, in a way?
Yes, it did. And certainly across the class spectrum, there was more sex in this period out of marriage than there was before or after. The number of illegitimate births doubled in the war from the 5 years before the war. Amongst my writers, there wasn't a tremendous amount of sex with people from other classes, apart from Henry Green, who had a very passionate love affair with a former Cockney, as she was known, having had elocution lessons, Mary Keane, who sort of had a tin leg and had grown up in a slum, but was one of the two most beautiful women in London, which apparently was a sort of categorisable list in those days. But I think, yes, it was partly the sort of democratisation, but also partly just the sense of living for the moment, and also the chaos that no one quite knew where anyone was, and so it was somehow easier to find yourself in the corner of a shelter having sex with someone, or sort of find Graham Greene was often in his workroom with Dorothy Glover, and it was quite natural that he wouldn't have gone home to his house in Clapham when the whole city was being bombed. So I think that's part of it, but it's primarily the joy of the moment, I think, that allows it.
And just tell us a little bit about the landscape of the city at this time, because again, it so comes to life. You have these visions of people in the subway, in the underground, as it were, hiding from the bombs, or in their shell, in their often kind of seemingly rickety self-made bomb shelters. But they would come up at the end of the day, especially where we are sitting now, and they would survey the street, and another building would be gone, their neighbour's house would be destroyed. And also, I think that sense of darkness, you know, this idea that, you know, you couldn't have lights on at night. And I imagine what it must be like to be in London as it is now. It must have been eerily beautiful and extraordinary and an unusual place to live.
I mean, certainly the whole landscape changed. And I think in a way these writers were lucky that because they already had a kind of aesthetic sensibility, they were perhaps able to appreciate this more. So there's a letter from Graham Greene to Anthony Pearl where he says sort of London is really quite pleasurable these days, with the strange effect of the ruined churches makes them look almost Mexican. And you sort of don't imagine that people in the East End are sort of going around saying this is all quite pleasant. But yes, there were all sorts of really amazing new landscapes in a familiar city. So you get the moonlight and the searchlights in a completely blacked out world, and the fire on top of that, the sort of Henry Green is great at the colours of the fire, the sort of pinks and oranges and unexpected colours. You also get the sense of this surreal site where sort of houses have almost gone inside out. There was a surrealist painter who was going for a walk with a writer and sort of pointed at a tree with clothes hanging on it and said, of course the surrealists have been painting this sort of thing for years, but it took us a long time to catch up in real life. And there was that sense of sort of London becoming a painting.
And finally, how much do you think their writing in later years was, you know, was a product of the experiences they did have during the war?
Oh, hugely. I mean, the second half of my book really explores what I think are each writer's greatest works, which were written after the war in response to their experiences during the war. So Graham Greene's The End of the Affair, Elizabeth Bowen's The Heat of the Day, are their most autobiographical works and also, I think, their greatest, and imbued throughout with the texture of war and with their wartime experiences.
And that was Andrew talking to Dr. Lara Feigl earlier on. And that's it, folks. It's all over for edition 186 of the Monocle Weekly. Everything was great. The guests were great. Henry Hitchings was very fascinating, wasn't he? Dr. Lara Feigl was great.
Yeah.
And Tony Juniper, always a pleasure to talk to. But best thing was the theme tunes, right? For Tom Edwards. It's kind of tough to beat that.
It's been a bit of a kind of secret the whole week. They've been being made and mixed. I think more people got involved and excited about the idea of ambushing him with his with those than anything else. And bless him, he had to kind of carry on despite the kind of the theme tune that was developing around his stories.
I'm glad that it was only one story about sort of sectarianism in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, I think he may have to lower his tone a bit in the coming weeks.
I found this funny thing. I know it's going to have to be like the funniest things I've seen on YouTube with Tom Edwards. It's going to have to be like the funniest thing I've seen on YouTube editor, isn't it? It had to be this is the hilarious columns down the right hand side of the Daily Mail Online editor.
Funny things cats have done this week. That's the kind of story we're going to need.
That's what we need. We can change the theme tunes, according to whatever he wants to say. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall and researched by Josh Fennett. That's new, isn't it?
Yes, he's kind of easing his way in off the front desk. He's been kind of front of house, but he's started doing some research for the shows.
Nice. And our studio manager was Jack Phillips. We'll be back at the same time next week, won't we, Andrew?
I will be.
And it just remains for us to say ciao.
Goodbye from me.
Thanks for tuning in.